Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ready? Welcome to Food for Thought, Woo-hoo! A podcast gabfest where in a multiracial mix of queer writers gather around the table to talk about sex, identity, culture, what we like to read, and who we like to read. Food for Thought, what's the icing on your cakes? Semen.
Oh my God.
Thank you.
That hole would taste so much better if there was frosting on it.
I mean, no, but like, isn't the feeling when someone is like fucking you and then pulls out and comes on your ass and it, just the feeling of the wet semen dropping on you is just like,
I'm not into that. I'm really not. I'm a very like, kind of like, I hate like messes and stuff. So I'm kind of like,
that's why I swallow. Yeah.
Like, cum does not turn me on.
I just want it everywhere. I want to take a cum bath.
Oh my God. I also am, again, like Joe, I love it. I want it everywhere.
No. I think it's really romantic when they come inside you.
Aww. I mean, as you do. I want it in there too.
Because then I don't have to clean
it. There's no mess. Your butthole is just a semen pocket.
Yeah. When a top is like, where do you want me to come? When a top is like, where do you want me to come? I legitimately don't know how to answer the question because I'm just like, where don't I want you to come? Like, everywhere.
I hate to say this, but I agree with Dennis.
Wow. Yes. Have you guys seen that a lube that is looks exactly
yes,
like
I
cum?
Have.
It's
using
really
it in the
realistic.
Porn.
I was honestly very into
it's
it.
It's really fun.
Really? Has anyone tried it?
You guys like it?
I've interacted with it. I went to like the sex store down the street and I was like playing like, with it. It's really
there's interacting. Water-based lube is often hard because it dissipates so quickly, but there's this really good white water-based lube made by Boy Butter that does look a lot like cum.
Wow.
Feels amazing. Doesn't stain your sheets. Staying power. And it looks like you're coming the whole time.
Wow. We're not being paid for this either. We're
not
being paid for this.
The white lube.
Why you gotta advertise the white lube?
Why you gotta advertise the white lube, Joe?
That's
the
white privilege. White lube supremacist.
Well, sounds like you. Anyway,
on that, I am Tommy Teebs Pico, an indigenous American poet, screenwriter, and I'm a recent adopter of this strain of weed called Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Let me tell you, convert.
Alex just got so excited. Alex is in this dude and was like, oh fuck, I just remembered I'm sober again.
Fully taking a vape pit in the back.
Just turned around and Alex was like,
producer,
I'm not.
We
Alex.
Thought it was a humidifier in the room. Actually, it's just Alex's vape coming out of her mouth.
Disgusting.
I'm Joseph Osmondson, scientist, nonfiction writer, and producer Alex, retract my life.
Actually, though.
Actually, you would benefit from that. I'm Dennis Norris II, and I'm a reader and a writer and a former figure skater. And as of today, my new nickname for my pussy is my coochie cat.
Tommy's face is all of our faces right now.
That's okay. So. I ain't letting any of y'all near my coochie cat anyway.
I'm Fran. I'm a writer. I'm an editor, and it's Sagittarius season, so I'm extremely scared of Tommy and Dennis right now.
Their power is
the height of our power.
The fire is here. Okay.
Who wants to get the menu this week?
Today, we go back to a food for thought classic called Gay Bar or Steakhouse. For our main discussion, we search for a safe space, and for dessert, we take it slow.
Take it away.
I'm feeling a little peckish. I think we should start the top of this show the way any good time should, with a little tease, our uproarious appetizer segment, Amuse Bouche. And to amuse our bouches, Joe is not going to be disgusting.
It is impossible for me to not be disgusting. I'm so sorry. Yeah. I am physically repulsive. We are playing a classic game called Gay
True.
Bar
it's
or Steakhouse.
Not a punchline.
I am a walking punchline, yes. Punch me.
Oh, God.
with your fist in my butt.
See, then you go around and say some shit like that. And I'm like, yeah, you actually are disgusting.
Listen, the beloved, if you're listening,
we're on time right now.
So this is a game wherein I give the name of a thing and you'll have to guess if that thing is a steakhouse or a gay bar.
Okay.
Both have a lot of meat in them.
Pretty self-explanatory.
First up, we have Stacy's. We're going to start off kind of innocuous. Stacy's.
Okay. I feel like Stacy's is a steakhouse. It's my bet.
I think Stacy's is a gay bar where everyone has to wear like diner waitress outfits.
Oh my God. That's
Subscribes,
beautiful.
Goes.
I also think it's a gay bar with a very specific dress code.
It is indeed a gay bar.
It's a gay bar. Isn't it here? No. Palm Springs?
I don't remember.
It's in Palm Springs.
It's in Palm Springs. That's right. Stacy is in Palm Springs. All right. Next up, the cockpit. The cockpit.
I bet you that's a steakhouse because it's too on the nose to be a gay bar.
I mean, have you met gays? Gays right. are very on the nose.
Yeah, they're very on the
nose. They're on the nose. They're on the mouth. They're on the butt.
The other day, I went
anywhere.
To a gay bar and it was called the Gay Hole.
I'm just kidding.
Gay Hole cum semen bar.
Oh, I'm going to open up a gay bar called the Coochie Cat.
No.
I think cockpit is a gay bar. It has to be a gay bar.
It has to be a gay bar.
It's a
gay bar.
It is a steakhouse in St. Lucia.
Wow. That was a trick question.
Lucia. All right. What about the White Swallow?
Oh, Lord.
Oh, my God.
I actually know the answer to. It's a gay bar.
Damn it, Fran!
And it actually helped cultivate a lot of Los Angeles gay culture here. Or San Francisco.
San Francisco
gay culture. It was legendary.
Yeah, it's since closed, but it is indeed a legendary San Francisco gay bar.
I feel like when Teebs drinks White Claw, he engages in the White Swallow.
Sorry.
I feel like you engage in the White Swallow quite often.
All the time. This is slightly fudged and unsubstantiated queer history, but I've heard before that, you know, back in the day before, like, when gay bars were illegal, that places like the White Swallow were code for places that were safe for queer people, because if it had a color and an animal in the bar, it was like a signal to people.
Oh, wow.
So you'll see a lot.
Oh, wow.
There were a lot of bars of yore that had like, they were, these are not real, but like the red fox.
Or the green pig.
Yeah.
Oink, oink.
Or maybe it was only birds. I should look it up.
The
but anyway,
gray puma.
The gray puma. Okay. I love this one. What about the meat bazaar?
Oh,
I hope it's a gay bar. That's what I'm going to say. I am there. And if they don't serve burgers, I'm going to be mad.
That's really imagine it's like actually a vegan gay bar. I'm going to go ahead and say steakhouse.
I'll double down on
it. It is a
that.
Steakhouse in Las Vegas. You can go to the meat. I wish it were called the Bazaar Meat.
Yeah.
That would be my gay bar really name. What about the back door?
I know the answer to this one.
No!
Because I actually helped open it in Bloomington, Indiana.
Oh, wow.
I was working for the local newspaper when I was there at the time, and I helped create a lot of press for their launch. I think there are a few other gay bars called the back door, but the one in Bloomington is really good if you've never been. It's great.
It's gotta be. Gotta be, yeah.
It is also a steakhouse.
Oh! No way! Trick question.
It's a steakhouse in Ohio, Dennis, of all places.
Oh, my God.
The steakhouse is the first thing that came up, actually. What about in between?
That's not very on the nose. Maybe steakhouse.
I think that's a vegan steakhouse.
They
only serve Impossible Burgers.
Oh, Cory Booker's steakhouse.
Oh my God. Ew.
Just to be a contrarian, I'm gonna say it's a gay bar. It's a gay bar exclusively for Log Cabin Republicans.
It is a gay bar. It is a gay bar.
And if it's for Log Cabin Republicans, that means they only play Taylor Swift.
Maybe in Tatra Hall.
She is like the Log Cabin Republican mascot.
Oh, she so is. What about the beef and bone? The beef and bone. And it's an N, by the way. Beef and bone.
That is neither a steakhouse nor a gay bar. It's the title of my memoir. Okay. So fuck off. My lawyers will be in touch.
I'm going to go with gay bar because I like bone as a verb.
Well, I'm going to say aspirationally gay bar.
It is fully a steakhouse, the beef and bone. Bone, the Beef and Bone. Mm,
very mad
we could
about
turn
this.
It into a gay bar. If we
yeah,
wanted.
We definitely could. Mm-hmm. Let's
good
do
friends.
This.
Good friends, steakhouse or gay bar.
That is the most boring gay bar I've ever heard of in my entire life. It's like the Pete Buttigieg of gay bars.
What did you say, Dennis?
I feel like it's a gay bar for, very just boring basic gays.
Dennis, I've literally been there with you. It's in New Orleans. We went together.
We did?
Yes, we went to Good Friends. My God.
Which one was it?
Do you exist in the world?
I mean, first of all, we all know the answer to that is no. And second, how drunk was I?
You were wasted, but I was too. The only reason I remember is because I had been before.
Is that the one where we were on, like, we were way, like, up on the second floor outside on that
yeah,
patio?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was scared I was going to fall over the railing.
Yeah, love that.
Yeah.
Love that.
I'm always scared I'm going to jump off the railing.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, okay. I was scared Fran was going to push me over the railing. But, you know.
More likely. Yeah. More likely. Yeah, yeah.
Next up, The Edge.
Ooh. It's Joe's favorite practice is what that is.
I do like edging.
You like edging?
I do like edging.
I wish I could edge.
I don't have the time.
I can't. Yeah,
but it feels so luxurious in that way. You know, you're really giving yourself to it.
I would like.
That's your white privilege speaking.
I also, you know, I'm more of a dribbler than a shooter when it comes to coming.
Wow.
Except for when I edge.
Wow.
Oh, girl.
TMI.
Can I TMI? I am a shooter. Every time. It's crazy. Every time. If I'm sleeping with someone new, they're like, Are you okay? Because not only am I shooting, but like it's like a lot. Mm-hmm. Like I could have come like that day, and it will still.
I come a
so
lot,
much.
But it doesn't go very far. Yeah,
I think it's because my urethra is very thin, and I think there's physics to that. You're a physicist
it's all the
or something, right?
That I've
wow,
done,
right? even Fran's sperm is highly aggressive.
I just
to point that out.
That's so funny.
Oh my God,
this is fucking disgusting.
It is so gross. The Edge is both.
Oh, okay.
It is a steakhouse in Utah, of all places.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And also a gay bar right here in LA, apparently. Although I've never heard of The Edge, but apparently it does exist.
Let's
here.
Go after this.
I'm good.
How about Captain Ratty?
R-A-T-T-Y. Oh, I really hope that's a gay bar.
Ratty.
That is the gay bar co-owned by Thomas Teeps People.
So now you know what my side hustle is.
You have to be above 6'3" to get inside.
Yeah,
that's your third alter ego.
Yes. Captain
Tom Ego Teebs and
Captain Ratty. Do you remember in Parks and Rec when Ron Swanson had his like jazz persona with the glasses?
Yeah, yeah. That's you. You're Captain
that's
Ratty.
My Captain Ratty.
Captain Ratty.
Fully my Captain Teebs. Ratty.
Captain Ratty is fully a steakhouse.
Oh, that's not a very appetizing name for a steakhouse.
Name. How is that place
I kind of wish it was a gay bar for
me. Same. I'm much more willing to put that kind of ratty meat in my mouth than at a steakhouse. I'm just saying.
Producer Alex has gone fully astral.
Just Jesus saying. Talking about sucking rat cock over here.
Ew!
Okay.
I can't.
Well,
okay. What about Swallow at the Hollow?
Love rhyme. I'm a poet.
I hope to God that that is a steakhouse.
My new pussy name is The Hollow.
No! I mean, I'm empty inside.
You
no. matters.
I mean, you truly are. Swallow at the Hollow. No, I need that. No. I need that to be a...
It absolutely I think your pussy name is Sleepy Hollow.
Oh, you know, she loves to sleep. She loves to sleep. Sleepy Hollow and a lot of headless horsemen come through there.
Oh, what does that mean?
I don't even know. But
actually, no, because grinders always have their heads cut off.
That's
only
right.
Torsos.
They're always headless.
True, headless horsemen. Yeah. That's good.
And sometimes they say they're horse hung, so.
Oh, yeah.
Headless horse
they
hung?
Say that.
Headless horse, say
the horse hung?
Horse hung? Swallow at the Hollow is a steakhouse.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
Love it.
Is it in Sleepy Hollow?
I don't. It's in Baltimore. It is in Baltimore. Wow. Yeah. Uh-huh. Where everything is great. Last up. Cut.
Uncut.
It's got to be both.
There should be I hope it's a steakhouse and next door is a gay bar called Uncut.
Yes. Owned by the same people. Owned by the same.
You know,
it has to be to the left of it.
The first tattoo artist that I got linked up to in Brooklyn had a tattoo parlor called Goose, and next door was a bar called Duck Duck.
Duck Duck. Oh, yeah, yeah. I know that.
I like that.
That's a little twee, but it's cute.
Around the corner
cute.
From where I used to live, where Dennis took over my room. Because I was at the Montrose stop on the L train. Yep.
Yes.
Yep,
cut,
yep, yep.
Cut, cut, cut.
I think it's both. It has to be both.
Do we like cut men or uncut men?
I'm a narcissist, so uncut.
I feel like it's bad to have a preference.
I love dick.
Yeah, I just love dick. So yeah. It doesn't really
like stigma matter. Around uncut dicks is probably racist.
It's weird.
Is there a stigma?
I think so. Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, when I think about specifically about Latinx, like uncut cock, that's like such a an archetype in like grinder culture.
Oh yeah, I guess that's true.
I think I prefer uncut because they're just easier to get off. If you know how to use it,
oh my god, if you don't know how to use it,
it can be a learning curve if
that first uncut dick is in your face right now, do not yank down when you're sucking it.
Oh yeah,
then I mean yank down.
Yeah, you can pull down, but you don't
gentle and see how it goes. Cut is a steakhouse. It is fully a steakhouse.
Damn.
Yeah,
if
I know.
There's got to be a gay bar out
somewhere.
There.
Let's Google somewhere. It. Posting. Cut gay
if
bar.
If not, maybe we start a venture? Food for thought?
No, I don't think there is a cut gay bar. No.
Oh, wow.
Just a steakhouse.
Listen,
enjoy.
Y'all, coming soon to those streets.
Thank you for playing.
Cha-ching! Get out your coin purses, binges. It's time for Penny for Your Thoughts.
I really hate that, Dennis. I hate that so much.
Which is exactly why I love to do it.
And the Penny for Your Thoughts, if you don't know, is our advice segment where, you know, a bunch of deeply unqualified people. I mean, Joe is allegedly a doctor.
I am a doctor, but also a fucking idiot.
But like, right, kind of doctor.
Important context. So dumb.
But doctor.
It's fine.
Just because hashtag butt explodes once.
Oh. Well, anyways, time to answer some questions. First up, hi thoughts. I've recently listened to your episode about marriage with guest speaker Meredith Toulousen. That's from the last season. It was a really good episode. You guys should go listen to it.
I love her.
I think Joe brought up the term homonormative. I found the concept very interesting. Who coined the term? How did it come to be? What acts or practices are considered homonormative? Coming from a strict Arab Muslim background, I never thought the word homo would have norm appended to it during my lifetime. I love your podcast. Listening to you guys is my escape and regular reminder that it certainly does get better.
It does not.
Homonormativity. Let's start with a very simple definition. Do you want to take this one, Joseph?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, homonormativity is talking about assimilationist homos, right? So it's more about norm being the culture and then the homo being assimilating into that. So what that means is sort of upper middle class institutions, marriage, having sort of relationships that are very tightly mere heterosexual relationships, sort of monogamous relationships, very long-term relationships, not polyamorous, kind of being a nuclear family, which is a very deeply heterosexual and, I might add, capitalist institution. So kind of aspiring to that as the end goal for queerness.
As well as on that, homosexual couples that take their privilege and kind of use it to traverse, obstacles in ways that other queer couples cannot, right? It's kind of an ignorance of your own privilege and what exists within that, homosexual relationship and the ways that you kind of are able to take advantage of certain opportunities.
For sure. And I think that, the question – one of the things that's been an interesting tension in gay rights in the last 20, 30 years is that, we've had expansion of rights such as the right to marriage, the right to be in the military, and that has sort of been driven by a normative gay person, largely white, upper middle class. But those rights then, once they're extended, do have an impact for people, for example, who, are married to a person who's an immigrant, and they are able to, through the right to marry, get access to, American citizenship for people who need it. So it's this really kind of complicated situation where, as long as institutions like marriage exist, I think we as homosexuals got to argue that we should have access to those institutions in the same way that straight people is. But it's more about the aspiration, right? Homonormativity is your imagination stops at gay marriage. That's it. That is the extent of possibility. Whereas, a lot of queer theorists say, no, queerness is actually, be married if you want to be married, but it's not about accepting that that's the only possibility or the only option. It's about queerness breaking institutions and expanding the notion of family and having big kinship families and caring for one another in that way and imagining other institutions than the ones that are handed to us by culture and society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
I feel like homonormativity is just like queer gentrification or something.
It literally is exactly that. I mean, yes. Outside of marriage, like other kind of side effects of homonormativity are like sex shaming, you know, not you as a gay or queer person being like, we don't have to be sexual in order to be gay. You know what I mean? Like there's so much like internalized homophobia in statements like that. Mm-hmm. Misogyny, so like a concrete maleness to homonormativity like trying to cramp like women's creativity or women's
anti-trans
liberty. Anti-transness, politics. Exactly. I mean, like, you know, you asked who the writer asked who founded the term. It was Michael Warner in 1991, but you know, Adrian Rich has the notion of compulsory
heterosexuality.
Notion of compulsory heterosexuality, create a body of work about like what it means in terms of like lesbians and radical feminism, specifically trans-inclusionary radical feminism that, you know, lies within that kind of like homonormative existence. It's really honestly, I don't want to say it's like gay people who aren't queer, but it's gay people.
But it's gay people who aren't queer.
I think that is an over-centralization of it. It's to say gay people who feel like other queer people's existence is somehow detractive of theirs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Or who even just refuse to acknowledge
other possibilities.
The other forms of existence and sort of feel like the movement stops at marriage equality. Yeah.
Exactly. It's the same way that, you know, like conservative people like weaponize their religion and say, like, I can't enjoy my religion if you're married. You know what I mean? It's so bonkers that, like, those, you know, these kind of different structures eat each other and that, but, like, it really is not that dissimilar to, like, the way bigots operate.
Yeah, I mean, it's respectability politics, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's okay
it's
if
like
you're
people
gay.
People trying to get to some kind of legitimacy where, like, institutional legitimacy, excuse me, that didn't have us in mind when it was, when the institution was created.
Right.
And it's like, why can't we come up with our own, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And this is not to say, just disclaimer, that if you want to be married or are married, that you're all, like, immediately just super, super homonormative.
Right.
That's not
Stop
what
it,
we're
Joseph.
Saying. Like the one booing is the one who most wants to be married,
correct.
I would say,
show.
On this
yeah.
show.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like,
I hate gay marriage because I'm not gay married.
Yet. Yes. I would love to be married one day, I think. But it's just the idea that your sensibility sort of stops at this one thing versus, you know, acknowledging and still continuing to fight for the fact that there are so many people in the world who have so many different like versions of queerness, and all of them need to be empowered and celebrated.
I'm curious to what your, and I know we're spending a lot of time on this question, but I'm curious as to what your opinions are on overcoming homonormativity, because, you know, we know the demographics, we've seen the stats on our podcast, and we have a predominantly male audience. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of gays that listen to the audience that might feel polarized or might feel like they're doing something wrong by listening to us talk about like what homonormativity means. Do y'all have advice about like how you overcame this yourselves, because we all come from this journey in some way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all, you know, incubated in like heterosexual heteronormative culture, mm-hmm. right? I, you know, grew up very much in a family that valued commitment, monogamy, marriage over essentially anything, and it was very nuclear in its family structure. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I didn't realize it was a prison until I realized it was a prison, if that makes sense. You know, it felt like I was striving for that thing, but then as I was going through my life and I sort of failed to meet that metric, and then I had shame about that. And so it was kind of like this iterative process of undoing at least the shame. Like, I was allowed to be sad about the sad things that happened to me, but then like feeling guilty for failing to meet this like aspirational goal of perfect monogamy and marriage that, by the way, straight people don't fucking do anyway. They all cheat on each other. They're like trash,
they're
hot
mess.
Messes.
They're a mess.
You know, and so that is a lie. The notion of like heteronormativity is a lie, even to straight people. Like, no one meets that goal. So,
yeah, they may not be cognizant of it, but that's true. I think for me, because I also, similarly to Joe, I grew up in a very like nuclear family, love, marriage that was like really central. And I wanted that for a long time. And I would say that for the most part, I still do want to be married, but it was all about exposure. Like, when I was in high school, at the same time that I was realizing that I was gay and coming out, that was when I was watching Queer as Folk on TV and the central character, Brian Kinney. I mean, it's a very cis white gay show, but the character, Brian Kinney, who's kind of like the axis around which the world revolves, is super, super kind of anti-homonormativity, and he's very outspoken about it. They don't use that language, but that's really how he is. And so kind of like
having that exposure very early in my understanding of myself was really formative to me, because I always understood, like, pretty much as soon as I understood that I was gay, I also understood that being gay meant that I didn't have to live my life in the confines within which I grew up. Mm. That was really
What about
really
you,
cool.
Fran?
I mean, read a book.
Read a book.
I think that always helps. My other thing is that give into your impulses. Because it's just like a very queer thing to do. Like we there's hegemonic structures that like help us that teach us to feel like our impulses are incorrect, and like you just have to give into the things that bring you joy, that bring you pleasure, that that feel taboo or feel off. You have to give into those impulses. It's just the queer thing to do.
At the very least, question that. Like, right? Like, question why they're taboo. Question why the things that feel like rules are rules. Question what those rules are in place to do.
What about you, TBZ?
Nothing too much to add that hasn't already been said. I mean, you know, stay curious, check in with yourself, stay vigilant. Don't think of institutions as a place of arrival, but rather as a place of like, as a place to collect and then keep moving forward. You know, I think, a part of it, you know, like a part of talk therapy is like you say the thing and you see the subtext and you turn the subtext into text and you actually start working on the issue and not like, and not one of the symptoms or whatever. And I think if, you know, the issue is compulsory heterosocialism. that it's just like
the only type of socialism I hate.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's like just be aware of it and be curious. You know, if it's, I mean, you also like what you like. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not here to tell you to like something you don't like. If you want to get married or whatever, we've already talked about that. But it's like, if you somehow feel that your quote unquote failure to meet that institution gives you some kind of shame, that's when I'm like, no. I think you just have to check in and feel out, like Joe said, like figure out how to undo the shame or figure out how to confront the shame or figure out at least how to see it. So you know it's there and it's not like this unseen force that's exerting influence over your life.
That's so true. Shame is so much easier to tackle when you name it as such.
This message comes from iHeartRadio sponsor Mercury Insurance. If you're looking to save some money, you should really think about getting a quote from Mercury. Because Californians save an average of $677 with Mercury. It's quick and easy, and in just a few minutes, you might find you could save a lot of money on your auto and home insurance. Plus, Mercury was named one of America's best insurance companies by Insure.com 4 years in a row. Low rates, big discounts, great insurance. Go to MercuryInsurance.com today to get a quote.
It's crazy how much we have to pay for outdated, impersonal healthcare, and even crazier that we all just accept it. It's time to face facts. Healthcare is backwards. Luckily, there's Forward, a new approach to primary care that's surprisingly personal and refreshingly straightforward. Forward never makes you feel like just another patient. Backed by top-rated doctors and the latest tech, Forward gives you access to personalized care whenever you need it. Using in-depth genetic analysis and real-time blood work, Forward's top-rated doctors provide you with in-depth insights to better understand your genetics, mental, and physical health. They then create custom, easy-to-understand plans to help guide you to achieving long-term health. With Forward, you get unlimited in-person visits with your doctor and access to care anytime via the Forward app, all for one flat monthly fee. It's time to stop accepting backwards healthcare and start moving your health forward. Visit GoForward.com today to learn more. That's GoForward.com.
It's time we get to the meat of our conversation, the thought process spelled T-H-O-T.
T-H-O-T.
And Fran's got some meat for us.
That's right. So we were doing a 2.0 of a conversation about safe spaces that Dennis and I actually did in Provincetown a while ago.
So
and
fun.
We were drunk and don't remember any of the conversation.
True.
But I do remember that it was profound.
It was very good. There was a lot of applause.
Yeah.
That's how I feel like when I get high, to be honest with you. I don't really remember it, but it was profound. Right. Definitely. A lot of applause.
But one of the resolutions that came from that conversation was that safe spaces, or the word safe space, the term, is like by and large a buzzword more than it ever is a practice. Mm-hmm. You know, who gets to decide what makes a safe space? Who even gets to kind of like create the parameters and the checkboxes of like who feels safe? And then the question of safe for whom? Because more often than not, you can't make a space safe for one community and another at the same time if those communities are at odds, you know, per se. Mm-hmm. But to launch it off, I'm curious, when you think of a safe space, what is the first place that comes to mind for you personally?
I find that it's very difficult for me to, you know, be intimate with people. It's better when the relationship is theoretical. And I think because of that, and also I like being alone, but with a suggestion that somebody else might be there. The page, to be honest with you. Like, literally the page is like the place that, like, nobody else is going to see it. I'm completely in my own head, my own devices. I've done so much work in my life to actively not have the editor voice when I'm, like, doing my drafts or whatever. And so I feel very, like, life might be constricting, but I can do anything I want in this place.
Wow. And how does that relate to, like, when you actually share it publicly?
Right.
Right. Well, then I have to let go of it because it's not mine anymore.
Wow.
Is it no longer safe?
I don't think so. No. Because then hella people have interpretations that you didn't even, like, mean.
Exactly. Right.
And then they
They want to talk to you about it, slide into your DMs about it.
But honestly, let them, because everyone's reading is valid if it's theirs.
Yeah. Right. And you always have another blank page.
I have another blank page. That's the thing. Yeah, I think of like a safe space as like some place that's not necessarily an arrival, but a progression.
For sure.
And so it keeps changing.
For sure. Yeah. Mine is definitely, I everyone here knows that I am a commitment addict.
Fiend.
And mine are very small moments. I feel very, very safe in the kitchen cooking for someone I love.
With a knife in your hand.
With a knife. I feel most safe with a knife in my hand. Yeah, julienning fucking red peppers. And I feel, it's just so stupid, but it's so true. When I'm cuddling with a boyfriend, I feel just incredibly physically disgusting. Held and safe and present.
Yeah. I will say, though, you're that disgusting. I found that recently as well.
Tommy!
Where I slept all night with somebody, like, in their arms, and it was like... And I just woke up 8 hours later, and I was like, what the literal fuck is going on with my biology right now?
My body does the thing where I'll wake up in the middle of the night just enough.
Because like, that's your sleep apnea.
To pull someone into me and like just to feel their body and feel how pleasurable that feels, and then back asleep.
I really envy that. I can't remember the last time that I felt safe with another man.
I mean,
like, literally fair. Not joking. I can't remember if I've ever really... I mean, that's not true, but... not a man, you know.
My safe space is my weighted blanket. So,
do they work?
They do work. Like, I sleep so much better now that I have one, actually. Like, I sleep much deeper. And it just sort of feels like I have some, which is like, there are some men in my life, you know, it's nice, but we're not together like that. So, like, it's nice to, like, just have that feeling. And I kind of prefer it to just a man because I can control it. It's my blanket. Like, it's kind of great.
This is the difference between a Pisces and a Sagittarius.
Yeah, so. No, it's actually
100%.
I was also gonna say that my safe space is actually the page, and I was gonna sort of say all the same things that Tommy's gonna say, and I feel that way. But so instead of repeating that, I'll say that one of the other major safe spaces in my life was on the ice, like as a figure skater, being in this place where that was how I began to really understand and know and feel like I had control over my entire body, my physicality. So like that was a thing. It became a part of my life at a time where I did not feel necessarily super safe in my home because of my emerging queer identity. I did not feel safe at all in my school. So that was like a safe space. There was a community of people that I knew loved me for who I was. And I just got to explore and kind of build up self-esteem at a time when I otherwise didn't have very high self-esteem. So that was and still is a really safe space. I remember actually on the day that my dad died, I was in Cleveland, and my family's house is like two blocks from the skating rink that I trained at. And so when I got back to the house from being at the hospital, I just got in the car and went to the skating rink, and I skated for like 2 hours.
Wow. Dennis, I mean, I think this is getting to one of the fundamental conflicts in safe spaces. Like, figure skating, of course, is like super fucked up in its race and class politics, right?
It's a mess. And it's a mess.
And yet it's a place that offered you as an emerging queer person
solace
and a safe space. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I can just say, so figure skating, it is a really, really like strange place. race, and also like around the way that they deal with sexuality between men and women and the age difference in pairs. Like there's a lot of messed up stuff that goes on behind the scenes. So I'll just say that, with sexual assault and all kinds of like weird things. But at the same time, theoretically, it's supposed to be a sport that really celebrates the individual and it looks at you, who you are as a person, what your abilities are. And it's like all about trying to build your outside presentation, like how you're going to present yourself based on your strengths and your talents and what you have to offer. And so in that way, it's kind of one of the first places where a lot of people learn kind of like what's good about them, like what things, what strengths and talents they bring to the table. But then it's really interesting because the whole idea is that you're shaping yourself in that way to put yourself out in front of a panel of judges to be judged on something, and you have no control over that. It's a very subjective thing. There's all kinds of biases that go into that. So it is a really strange sort of cognitive dissonance to be a person who's aware of those things and be involved in the sport. So not necessarily always as a kid, but as an adult.
So maybe it's like a place that it's like it offers a safety because it allows you to lose yourself.
Yeah.
All of y'all are actually touching on, I mean, we should like start to like work to define what it is, like a safe space is, but all of y'all are touching on kind of the exact same thing in very different ways. It's like all of y'all felt your safe space when you could come into your own and be the best at what it is that you do. With you, it's figure skating. With you, it's how you write on the page. And so with you, it's how you're partnered to someone and how you love someone. Ooh. That's so beautiful. Oh my God.
Wow.
What about you, Fran?
When I first thought, I was like, oh my God, this podcast is a safe space. But then sometimes Joe farts in the studio.
Sometimes.
Joe is not the only farter, though, at this table.
Right. Producer Alex heard me through the wall this morning.
That does not make me feel safe.
Okay? I heard you, too, when I was in my room with the door closed.
I heard you from Koreatown.
For me, it's always like when I'm having dinner with friends, similar to you, Joe. Like I feel like my best when I'm taking care of others and cooking for them and being a host for them and making sure that you know, they don't have to create any additional context or work or emotional labor to like just be there in that space. And so, I think about intimate places with my friends when we're making dinner.
Is the need for safe spaces, is the fact that the world is generally unsafe for queer people the assumption that leads us to need safe spaces?
Well, that's a funny thing, right? Because like it's like we shouldn't even like need or require safe spaces. Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, by default everything is unsafe for like marginalized groups, but in a perfect world, like, we wouldn't need these things. I don't know. For me, I think I get really like fucked up about like the idea of a safe space, because more often than not, I really do feel like the people, or rather the entities that are calling themselves safe spaces, really aren't for like a lot of queer people. When I'm thinking about queer safe spaces, I went to a party recently in LA that was like, I won't name the party, but like their whole MO was like, this is like for queer people of color and like trans and non-binary folks and blah, blah, blah. And I got there and it's a bunch of like white people like at a circuit party, like wearing harnesses. And I was like, this is not what you promised.
It's not advertised.
I was like, I was like, I thought this was supposed to be a safe space. And, you know, I'm being shady, but that's actually dangerous and irresponsible. Yeah. And I think about how the nomenclature of safe space, like industry safe spaces and entity safe spaces can get so dangerous because you're luring in people and promising something that they're not going to get and potentially bringing them into potential harm.
Speak on it. Just like, I remember after my first book tour and I was going, it was like 2016, so it was like a lot of election stuff, and there were places I remember going, like Boston, for example, when it did all of this lip service about being like, this place and this place and this place, safe for all races, safe for like da-da-da, and it was literally only white people.
Right.
They were still so segregated.
Exactly. And it's like, that's just not the tea. You know what I mean?
It's a mess.
And the flip side of all of this is just like, can we make safe spaces? Right. Like,
safe from what?
Exactly. Right.
Because is it like, okay, safe from physical harm? Is it safe from conflict? Is it safe from somebody challenging you?
Right.
You know, like, because I think like in defining what it is that you want to be safe from, then you can start to build a rhetoric around what the space is supposed to do.
And also, when you think about this, like at a brand level, like at a corporate, like capitalistic level, when you think about brands that are like, oh, there are brands out there or people out there that are like, oh, we are safe for everyone. Mm-hmm. But when you say, oh, we welcome in like queer and trans people, but then you're also like,
we welcome in like right wing nut jobs. Like everyone has a voice here. It's like you can't like bring like a fox in and like a chicken into the same house and be like, we're safe here.
Right, you know what
I mean? Well, like that's just like not how it works.
I think the question that I feel like you're getting to, Fran, which is something I think about a lot, is that when we do think about safe spaces, is it actually possible for someone who is it possible for the safe space to be made by the people who aren't the ones who need to be protected in that safe space? Like, that's what I'm always thinking about. So like when I was on a writing residency earlier this year, and there were some tweets about how unsafe of a space it was for me as a person of color and as a queer person and as a queer person of color, because I feel like those are in some ways sort of three related but independent things. And I was one of only two people of color there for the entire month. My hair was like touched unconsensually twice by two different white women. And these are just a few of the like really intense microaggressions that I experienced
the entire time. Burn it down.
And I finally went to the people who run this residency, and I was like, I responded to a call for applicants, essentially really, really advertising yourself as a safe space for people of color. That was the specific grant that I like applied for to be here. All these things are happening. You need to change my space. But also, like, I have feedback and I have thoughts about how you can make sure that this isn't a dangerous space. Like, that you're not just bringing more people of color and more queer people into this space and leaving them, like, to sort of sink or swim in this environment.
Yeah, just for, like, your website or your brochure or whatever.
Right. Where they're supposed to be able to get their work done. And it was so interesting because they weren't interested in hearing it. And I felt like they didn't know how much they didn't know. And I was just like, I'm talking to straight white people right now in a particular state. Like, I just feel like maybe I should have never trusted that in the same way. Like, whereas if I had gone to like a residency that was specifically for people of color or for queer people, and those do exist, maybe that would have been different.
Let's do that thing where like we pull in like actionables and like bullet points to like what we're talking about. So like we talked about how like when you are a safe space, you're not safe for everyone, period. That's just like a paradox. That's not how it works. You are safe for a marginalized group of some kind. So like that's something to think about. Something that you're naming is that like, or maybe you can help me work through this, but it's like, you can't say you're a safe space, but do zero actual labor to make sure that everyone convening this space is actually making sure that it's safe. Like, those people should have gone through like race sensitivity training or something like very 101 like that. Or like people should they just hire people that aren't shitty, people that aren't white.
Yes.
Hello.
And like intention matters, and that's great. Have an intention to not actively like, I don't know, like, yeah, okay, so you don't want us to die. Great. Wonderful. You want us to have an experience of being able to be open and creative and all that kind of stuff. But it's like intentional takes you so far without action.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I have a question though, and this might be, you know, my horrible white Marxism popping its head out. And Fran, you're saying, and I agree with you, that, you know, safe spaces, just because you're safe for one marginalized group doesn't mean you're safe for another necessarily. But isn't there a liberatory politics, a libertary possibility where the process of becoming a quote unquote safe space means that like you're dealing with oppression and power in that space, which applies then to race, to gender, to class, to sexuality. It's more about how you deal with power and difference, as opposed to like, I've had training on how to talk to people of color. That feels very like corporate to me, right? It's like, I've had training on how to deal with gay people. It's like, how do we actually deal? How do we acknowledge and deal with power in the space? And all of those things are across vectors of power: race, class, gender, sexuality, etc. And so if a space builds itself with a liberatory politic from the ground up, I wonder if it's not possible to have that possibility of like not just being safe for X group at the expense of Y, but actually being in practice from the beginning a space that deals with power as a definition of the space itself.
Let's concretize this though. What are the actionables? Like, what would you like prescribe to people that are trying to be better safe spaces? Like, I mean, liberatory politic, what does that look like?
There are people that are doing this type of work and it often fails, but you know, there are people who have spaces that are defined by like transformative justice. For example, any conflict in the space is dealt with in in an XYZ way. Anyone mm-hmm. who comes into the organizing or political space, anyone who comes into the school or art collective knows that, like, if something happens, if there's conflict between people, we have this public process. That's just how the space is built. Mm-hmm. It is a public accountability. And so that is sort of in the ethos of the space as it begins, right? And these conversations aren't things that are retroactive, like what you're saying.
Exactly.
Dan,
you
like
have the space and then you call it safe.
Exactly. Where you're like, no, or where you're responding to something fucked up, right? Mm. Where the only time you have the conversation is because a white woman touched your hair, Dan.
Right.
Whereas no, as
right.
opposed to that, we have conversations proactively about what we want the space to look like and not just like when shitty things happen, right?
Right.
So I think there are people trying to do this, but like one of the things that fucks me up is that like some of these spaces, these activisty spaces, these artivisty spaces, then it comes out, it's like, oh, it's like a space for XYZ people, and it finds out like women are getting raped in that space and it's being covered up, right? And so mm-hmm. it's like people are trying, but at the same time, like these same power dynamics keep fucking everything up.
Well,
it's hard
to get outside of a power dynamic when you're living inside of a power dynamic.
And we all are because of capitalism,
yes.
right?
And also if you're talking about somebody who's organizing the space and putting it together or advertising it as such, I imagine if you have the clout to create a space, then you have some power.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how do you interrogate your own yep. as you're yes. creating this space for people?
That is the tea. Yep, oh my God. That is solution based.
Love that.
Or
how do you give money and then nothing else?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like if you want to write a writer's residency that's a safe space, mm-hmm. give a shit ton of money, hire queer people of color to mm-hmm. run the thing from the ground up mm-hmm. and you do absolutely fucking nothing. You mm-hmm. fucking nothing. Disappear
just
from the space entirely.
It. Yep.
And it's not a fucking vanity project for your, like, whatever the fuck it is, you know? Ooh,
that's
speaking
it, really.
Of the nonprofit it's industrial like, complex.
That's okay. it, that, right? Because if you are seeking to create a safe space, your first question should be, why am I equipped to do this? And why yes. do I want to?
Yeah.
Mm. Right? Because if it is, as you're saying, Joe, like this kind of like self, you know, self-congratulatory or like resume building opportunity, mm-hmm. you are probably doing it for the wrong reasons, or you might be executing it and not really thinking about the wellness of others so yeah. much as you yeah. are thinking about what it looks like on a piece of paper.
And what it yeah. feels like, mm-hmm. yeah.
I have what it looks like on the website.
So I was wondering if you have any thoughts about like the co-option of safer spaces, like when, for example, a queer nightlife space comes up that's about a specific group of folk who might not feel safe at, like you were talking about, Fran, at like a circuit party that has nothing but white folk in it, mm-hmm. right? So it's like a party that exists in its ethos to be safer for X group, and then it's lit and it's really good and the buzz gets out and then it's 70% white people and all of those same microaggressions that were happening, you know, in all white nightlife spaces is now happening in this safer space. Like how do we talk about that? How do we deal with it? Is it fair to say like white people fucking stop coming to X party?
Right. I've always thought about this because when I think about like the, you know, the queer nightlife parties that are for specifically for people of color, I was like, this is a terrible solution, but like, what would it look like for the poster to be like, if you are white, don't come without people of color. You know what yeah. I mean? Like if you have like friend groups that are filled with people of color, like you're probably in the right space. Like yeah. you are allied to the people joining the space, and unless you're like a really fucked up person, I would really hope you're not tokenizing your one brown friend to get into a party.
Yeah.
Like that right. would be pretty transparent, pretty fast.
Or using it as a fetish,
right? Exactly, right. Because that's when it gets bad. I mean, yeah. like gentrification Ugh. Happens to like all nightlife, but like when you have like white guy coming alone because he like wants to hook up with like
or
people
worse,
of color
with his five white friends who exactly. all want to hook up.
Yeah, because oh. it's probably the best party that right. city has to offer. Yeah, like yeah. more often
yeah.
than not.
Yeah, I Tommy. Like the idea because it reminds me of a kind of best practices by people who are who talk about Hawaii
oh.
and talk about like mm-hmm. don't go unless a Native Hawaiian invites you.
Oh, wow,
I've never heard about that.
Yeah, and it's like something that kind of happens in like activists and academic circles and stuff like that. And so I just like have never thought of it as a place to go. But then I've recently become friends with a few Native Hawaiians, and they had invited me out, and I was like. I was like, I'm being invited by a Native because yeah. they wanted me to come. It was like Manichaea stuff and like activist stuff, and I was like, oh, okay, because I think that is a potential solution. Mm-hmm. It's like yeah. don't come unless somebody in the community invites you.
It's yes. so weird. I mean, this is Joe. I am white. Mm-hmm. I stopped going to Poppy Juice. I'm friends with Adam Rhodes. I've been friends with him since forever. I was going to that party. I had an ex who lived around the corner from One Last Shag, the mm-hmm. bar that it used to be at, mm-hmm. like when it very first started, and it was actually not. not even like a thing. There was no cover. It was just like some nights that bar would be a Poppy Juice party and they would be DJing.
And for context, Poppy Juice is a party in New York dedicated to queer people of color.
Queer people of color. And so I would just often be in that space with, you know, my friends who live in that neighborhood who were largely black. I stopped going when all the stuff around the white people infiltrating the space happened. I just don't feel good being in that space as a white person, no matter how many people of color I go with. Like, my boyfriend is going this weekend. I'm not going with him. I think it's fine for that, for me to, like, that's not a huge fucking sacrifice. You know what I mean?
Right,
it is a lit
right,
party.
Yeah.
But, like, there are a lot of people who don't feel good about white people there. And it's, like, fine that I don't go. It feels like that's me participating and making it a safer space. And that's chill.
Right. So, like, sometimes you just got to let people have their thing.
Yeah. You got to not go to Hawaii.
Yeah.
You, like, got to not
sometimes
go to the party.
You just, right. Sometimes, I mean, like, you know, if it's not for you, it doesn't have to be for you.
Right.
Exactly.
By being virtue of being alive does not necessarily give you access to everything.
You don't have to be everywhere all the time. And if there are a gajillion parties that are made for you, sometimes you're allowed to, like, acknowledge that someone needs something made for not you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
This
so
is like laddering back actually to things that we were talking about earlier and how, you know, there are so many spaces that are like, this is a safe space. And then you're like, no, it's not. But like, quick anecdote, like I do a lot of like consulting gigs and like, you know, talks with like ER employee resource groups at like, you know, other companies. And there was this one, I won't name the company, but there was this one gig that I did do where the whole reason I was brought into the space was to talk about safe spaces, period. Mm-hmm. They were like, what does a safe space look like? Can it be created? Whatever. Talk to our employees about, like, you know, how you start to be a good coworker. Mm-hmm. And I was very excited about it, actually, because I was kind of, I fucked with the company. I was very excited about it. And right before this programming starts, the guy who was orchestrating it kind of pulls me aside and he was like, oh yeah, by the way, like, I talked to HR ahead of time and like, we're really excited that you're here, but like, you can't mention the podcast at all. And I was like, wait, what?
Wait,
and I was like, the podcast doesn't have much to do with what I would say in the talk. Like,
right.
If anything, you know, it's just like my body of work, right? And I was just like, wait, what? And he was like, yeah, I mean, we like really excited to have you here, but like we flew like, you know, your whole thing by HR and like, you know, it's just not work appropriate. And I was like,
wow.
And I was like, wait. So you, person, trying to create a safe space environment have just now made me feel unsafe because my identity is not work appropriate? I was just like,
right.
What? That's literally the opposite of what HR should do.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
HR's job is to create safe spaces for, like, marginalized employees. And then you, HR.
No. I mean, I think that's the thing that I think about a lot, Fran, because when you're queer, your sex and sexuality is on the surface of your skin. Mm-hmm. And your body is deemed inappropriate in ways that make you like having a job. In some places, it's fucking legal to get fired for being queer, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, yes, part of being a safer space means that the fact of your sex and sexuality being a part of your visible body is not going to harm you in the way that it has for so long and does queer people all the time. And I think a big part of that for me is not so much rendering it's safe for us, but doing the queer theory thing where we acknowledge that everyone's sex and sexuality is present on their body.
Right.
It's just we only see queerness because it differs from the norm.
Right.
So it's like acknowledging that, well, first of all, straight people have a sexuality, and that second of all, straight people do abusive, fucking horrible, fucking terrible, goddamn shit all the time.
Cis straight people.
And the fact that they don't, you know, it's all kind of in hidden and it's a private, like a lot of the Me Too stuff that's coming up now, like silence or not being sexual at work is not the solution. It does not a safe space, a safe space make when fucking news anchors have buttons on their desk that locks women in their goddamn offices so they can be sexually assaulted, right? So acknowledging how unsafe the cis heteropatriarchy is, by definition, it is a violent ideology, way to structure society and way to live for everybody. And so rendering that visible to me, I think, is a huge part of making any space safer.
Yeah. I think of in terms of media and in terms of stuff that's kind of created to represent our communities in art or television or movies or music or whatever. There was a show that came out called Chambers that was a Netflix show that I was really excited to watch because the main character is an Indigenous woman. And there were like a lot of Indigenous actors, and it was like it took place in Arizona, and part of it was on the reservation. And I remember talking about it with some of my DNA friends because the main character is supposed to be Navajo, and they were just like, there were a lot of taboo things that people showed on that show that you just wouldn't if you were actually DNA. If you were actually Navajo, there were like there was certain imagery, there were certain uses of coyotes and some other stuff. And she's just like, I watched it, and my family, we were like talking to each other, and we're just like, I can't believe they put this on TV. This is not something that we talk about. And of course, it turned out that nobody in the room was Dine. One of them was one of the writers, one of the staff writers was Native. And I think that person had a Dine partner, if I'm not mistaken, but like had no other connection to. And then like it turned out that there was only one Native director of one of the episodes.
Right.
And the showrunner is not a Native person. Yeah. And she was like doing this interview with Entertainment Weekly where she was talking about like, they're like, oh, what was the impetus behind the show? It's a very particular type of show. And she was like, well, I knew I wanted it to be a teenage girl. I knew I wanted her to be going through these things that I call like 4 a.m. thoughts, which are just like about like permanency in life and where your soul goes after death, like da da da. And like EW kind of doubled down and was like, well, I mean, this is a Native character living in Arizona. What about that? And she was like, well, you know, I don't think Arizona's like really represented in film or in television that often, so I wanted to do that. And then she was
avoiding
like,
it at all costs.
Right. And then, then she was like, but like, you know, I don't see this as being like about a Native American girl. I see this about being a girl who happens to be Native American.
That
kind of that
bullshit.
But the thing is,
liberal
if
bullshit.
I could accept that if that person was from that community,
right?
And they wanted to make like a large, I could accept that. But the fact that this was not a person in the community or a Native person at all, I was like, how do you know what it means to be Native if you're not Native?
Yeah.
How can you prescribe indigeneity or non-indigeneity onto a character if you don't understand what that means?
Yeah,
if you don't have the lived experience of that?
That's
I mean, again, so it's like, it's not a judgment. It's just a question that I have. You know, if you're creating something with a kind of intention in mind,
right,
you know, how do you make sure that the fruition of that is what you intended? But the thing is, I don't think this person intended for it to be a Native story at all. It was
right,
like she was adamant about it being a girl and adamant about her being teenage and her going through some kind of thing about her body,
right,
whatever. But it seemed that her indigeneity was incidental. Her specific DNA indigeneity was incidental, and so that's what it felt like in the show.
It seems like what you're talking about, Tommy, is, you know, we're talking about safer spaces, and what you're talking about is the fact that culture itself is a space, and culture makers are making space when they're doing that, and that culture itself can do harm and violence, and culture itself can address harm and violence. And so for, you know, all of you young thoughts out there who are making work, think about making your work, your poems, your whatever, making that a safer space as well. You know, making your friend groups a safer space. Like, we are the politics that we live,
yes,
you know, and what does conflict look like in your friend groups? You know, are you making your relationship a safer space for your friends with how you deal with issues that arise that may have to do with the power differences between you, like race, class, or gender,
while also being able to gather them like a braid, you know what
I mean? Sometimes some people need to be gathered, you know. And so I think these things feel really big. They feel like it's about your workplace or about art that you're making, but it's so about how we treat each other on the individual, on the daily, and think about every one of your relationships being a space that you carry around with you constantly. And how do we try to act as though all of those spaces are precious and to make them safer as best we can?
I'm feeling like I'm full, but I could fit one more thing inside of me. Dennis knows how I feel.
Whoop, whoop.
Dennis, what we got for dessert today?
Okay, so today for dessert, I want to talk to you guys about the Netflix sitcom that I'm in love with and obsessed with. It's fucking hilarious. It's called One Day at a Time. Has anybody watched it, or is it just me?
It came out like years ago.
No, it is.
What year did it come out? It was like
probably 2017, maybe. It's been around for a while, and I actually didn't watch it until, like, I'm not super into family oriented sitcoms, so it just like wasn't on my radar until it actually got canceled earlier this year by Netflix, and there was such an outcry, and I was like, wait, like, I need to check out this show. So One Day at a Time is a Netflix remake of this sitcom
like
by Norman Lear
yeah,
from like
yeah.
1975, which was like a white family at that time. It's a Cuban American family. It's a single mom named Penelope who's a war vet, and she has a teenage daughter who's like maybe 14, 15 in the first season, who like has a burgeoning queer identity. And then she has a younger son, and her mother lives with them as well. And her mother's played by the glorious and legendary Rita Moreno.
Yes.
Ooh.
Incredibly, incredibly amazing performance from her. And so the show, the show's incredibly funny. Like, the main actress, Justine Machado, is incredibly talented. She's fucking hilarious. The writing is amazing. And also the kids are like really incredible. But what I also love about it is that it's a great example of how you can do comedy and do sort of like more socially aware, more like support, just comedy that's supportive of like justice, because they're also able to sort of make fun of certain things about our culture as it is right now. But they're still doing a great job. Like they've had essay like episodes where like she kind of deals with her teenage son's like burgeoning toxic masculinity and the way that he deals with women. And they have incredible episodes that deal with homophobia and homophobia in the Latinx community. When the father sort of, when the daughter comes out to her father, who comes back in an episode. So it's just a really wonderful, like, I was going to say network. It's a really wonderful show. And the first three episodes are still on Netflix, so people should go check it out. And
it got canceled.
But the first three seasons are still on Netflix, though. But it did get canceled. But then...
What?
Tell us, D.
Pop TV.
I don't know her.
Up. So yeah. Pop TV is a Canadian network.
It's amazing. Schitt's Creek is awesome. Yes, I love that motherfucking show.
It gave us Schitt's Creek.
Dan Levy.
So my third husband. He's going to be my third husband. Yeah. So anyway, it's been picked up by Pop TV. Apparently the dates for the fourth season have been released, but tententative dates, but I'm not quite sure what they are. But things are in progress and they're moving. So the show is still available and it's great. And also, sorry, one last thing that I forgot. It deals with mental health and mental health in Latinx community, because the main character, the mom, has some issues with PTSD from being in the war. And it deals with that in a really incredible way. And there's not a whole lot of conversation out there often about like mental health maintenance in communities of color. And the episode and conversation around that is really, really incredible.
And it's wonderful to get that in a comedy, because there's this thing that comedy does, which is kind of like it provides an access point for having these kinds of conversations when they would otherwise be maybe too dramatic or too uncomfortable or something like that. This is what I do in my poetry. I start off with jokes and then I'm like, genocide.
But it's the truth. It's the freaking truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds so great. I'm actually going to watch it.
Bookmarked.
Great. Bookmarked. So 4 years from now, you'll come back to me and finally be
no,
like,
we're not
yes,
you,
I watched
baby.
It.
We're not you. That's the thing.
This episode of Food for Thought is made possible by the generous, unequivocal support of Rosé and our new home at iHeartRadio. Our producer is very high right now, Alexandra DePalma. Our production manager is very high right now, Elizabeth D. And our social media manager is very high right now, Christina Tucker. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes, or Dennis goes back to the nonprofit industrial complex.
Don't make me do it. Don't make me go back.
Oh. I'm Tommy Teebs Pico. You can find me at Hey Teebs, HEYTEBS, on all relevant social media.
I am Joseph Osmondson. You can find me at www.josephosmondson.com.
I am Dennis Norris II, and you can find me on Twitter at The Earl Denden, TheEarlDenden.
And I'm Fran, the legend. And you can find me at Fran Squish Co. on any social media.
Legendary, baby.
Legendary.
Iconic.
Find us on Instagram as Gay Sluts Who Read, or Gay Sluts Horad, however you want to read that. And join us on Facebook and Twitter at Food for Thought Pod, where each week we pin some questions at the top of our page to continue the discussion of this week's main topic. Sign up for a newsletter to see a list of everything we're reading and some extra delectable content at Food for Thought Pod. Podcast.com. And finally, send your questions, thoughts, concerns, and dick pics to thoughts at foodforthoughtpodcast.com. As always, that is food, the number four, and thoughts spelled how?
T-H-O-T.
Yes.
Honestly, it's been so long since we've gotten dick pics. Get back in there.
You can leave me out. I'm good. I'm good. No, me too. My DMs are half Garfield memes and half dick pics. So
I need more.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.